This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing. I'm Patsy with a Z, and people are starting to call me the last of the red hot book lovers, which I like. But, you know, it is so exciting. Today I have two of my favorite guests and two of my listeners' favorite guests, and we're going to play just a little bit of music that will give you a hint of one of the books. Okay, for everybody, two authors who love Scotland as much as I do. It's so thrilling to welcome to Joy on Paper, Tasha Alexander and Andrew Child, who is also Andrew Grant. He wears two hats, and I am so happy to have you both on the program again.
Oh, Patsy, we are so happy to be here. There's nothing better than getting to chat with you.
Oh, you know, I know that you two love Scotland like I do, and you both have now such wonderful connection to it. Drew?
Good morning, Patsy. It's so nice to hear your voice. It's worth writing books just so we get to come on your show. We always look forward to it. So thank you for having us this morning.
We do. It's our absolute favorite.
Oh, thank you, because, you know, my listeners know you very well, because, first of all, we kept canceling the Lady Emily Tea Party.
Yes!
It was during the pandemic, and now you have this wonderful book. I get so thrilled when a book just grabs me, and you're going to be talking about your book, A Cold Highland Wind. It's a Lady Emily mystery, of course, and it is so good. So we know that, you know, we're going to talk a lot about Scotland. And Drew, I will tell you, and I told you this before, you, of course, worked in Scotland with your the Fringe group. You put on a lot of programs there, and I still have English woman who insists that you appeared on stage there, and she's trying to find the evidence. So one day she might have find it.
Yeah, that's scary. If she does find it,
that's it.
If she finds it, I would like to see it.
Yeah, it's going to be breaking news.
And you know, unless and until it emerges, I'm denying everything. I'm pleading innocence at all charges.
Well, you know, it's so much fun to talk to you both and to talk about Scotland, because, you know, so many people don't think of it as the destination trip. But with you, Tasha, you know, you are taking readers all through Europe, really in a grand tour, like in the old days, where readers, because you paint a picture of every location, and you just take us there. And this new book, I think, is just unbelievable. It's so good.
Oh, thank you so much. I mean, it's only been out for a little over a week, and, you know, this is my first event that I'm doing for it, because I like to have you first. And, you know, it's always a little nerve-wracking when you're waiting to hear what people think. Do they like it?
Well, it starts off, of course, I didn't even say the name of it, because I'm so thrilled. It's A Cold Highland Wind. And it was so funny. I was reading the book. Now, we've been 95 degrees for 7 months.
Oh, wow.
And then suddenly it just got cool, and it got gray, and it got windy. And as long as I, you know, had the AC on, I felt like I was in Scotland. It was a delightful read.
Oh, I'm so glad. Thank you.
Oh, and of course, you know, I love Lady Emily and I love her husband, but I really like having the boys with them.
Oh, I'm so glad. Well, you know, they made a very brief appearance in the Egypt book, and I just knew they had to be there in Scotland.
Well, that was a little nod to Elizabeth Peters. And
absolutely. I'm glad you picked up on that, because obviously that is what it was.
And she would love this one, because Scotland, of course, is so special, and having the boys there, and in this one, they get involved. And also, it's a dual storyline, and I love that. So why don't you explain what happens here, and why we have, and I was so surprised at the second storyline.
Yeah, well, you know, the second storyline was really the driving force between me deciding what I wanted to do with this story. You know, there's such a long and continuing history of people not getting to speak, right? You know, we know that people of color, even our society today, aren't getting the same kind of opportunities to speak that others do. And, you know, throughout history, marginalized people have obviously been marginalized. And I was reading some wonderful histories of, well, when I had decided that I wanted the book to be in Scotland, I, you know, started reading. And the work of some of the nonfiction authors writing about people of color in Britain in the Tudor era. And that's not something we think about, right? We're like, wait, what? And, you know, I came across, it started for me, I read an article about this, about these two young women who were literally given as a gift to James IV. I mean, can you imagine giving people as a gift? And they went on to live in the court, and, you know, they got to dress as courtiers, and, you know, they were living a relatively decent life. It wasn't like they were, you know, it wasn't like slavery in the South, in the United States, but, you know, they still were slaves. And so it just really started me thinking a lot about freedom and what that means, and how even if you're in relatively comfortable circumstances, if you have no agency over your own life, you have no freedom. And I think, you know, people have a tendency kind of to say, oh, well, this isn't that bad for this group of people, and it's not all bad. But, you know, when you really start getting down to what does it mean to have freedom, it's a really fundamental question. And I think, you know, you've got to say that every human deserves that. And so I wanted to explore that idea. And, you know, I wanted, that's where I came up with the character of Tansy. I wanted to write about what it would be like for a young woman who has been kidnapped and sold as a slave and then given as a gift. Given as a gift to someone who's relatively kind to her. And what does that look like? And then, of course, tie it into back to Emily so that Tansy's experiences can help Emily figure out what is going on in her present-day problems, which, you know, always involve a murder.
Well, we need murder. We need, absolutely. Explain where Tansy comes from and how she got there.
So Tansy comes from Tunisia. She grew up in Tunis. I can't speak. Oh my gosh, I really can't speak. Tunis. And she was out one day and was kidnapped. And, you know, she came from a well-to-do family. She's educated. She was living a good life, but she's kidnapped by a man who essentially uses her as a sex slave. And when he gets tired, so she's being just continuously raped. This is before the story starts, obviously. She's sold to someone else who gives her as a gift to a friend when that friend is getting married. And he is the laird at a castle in the Scottish Highlands. And he, well, the gift is really to his bride.
It
to
is.
His bride. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, it's just, it's so horrific to me, this idea that you would give someone as a gift, like your silver platter or something. Well, I couldn't decide between a place setting of your china or this human being, right? I mean, it's appalling. So Tansy, her name is Tansem, but the Scots can't pronounce it, so she just always gets called Tansy. And I think that's a thing with people who have a more ethnic-sounding name, and it's not just with the Scots, it's with all of us. When you have an ethnic-sounding name, a lot of times people just say, oh, I can't deal with that, and they call you whatever they want. And that's not okay. You know, you need to call people by their names. But she, broadly speaking, is treated well by her new mistress. But when the husband dies, because this was a second marriage for the laird, and this was a second marriage to a much, much younger woman, and his children were not fond of their stepmother. So when their father dies, the oldest son, who is the new laird, kicks them out of the house. So Tansy and her mistress now have to go live in the village, you know, and you know, the truth is neither of them is really capable of running a household. Tansy's a little better off because she's had some experience in the castle, but not a lot, you know. And her friend, her mistress, whatever you want to call her, Rosalind, has literally no experience. You know, she's been a pampered lady, and so we see the story of the two of them, Tansem and Rosalind, finding their footing in the village, figuring out how to support themselves, dealing with the problems that are probably more familiar to us. You know, how are you going to get food? How are you going to support yourself? Are you going to have a place to live? Are you going to be able to be safe? And when you're doing this against the background of the witch hunts that were rampant throughout Europe at this time, that storyline takes place in 1676. The witch trials in Scotland were really the most brutal in all of Europe. Something I did not realize until I started doing research for this novel. I mean, I knew, you know, we all have an understanding that there were witch trials and they were bad and there were all these executions. But Scotland.
Yeah, exactly. Most
was
people,
the worst.
You know, they think Salem, Massachusetts, and they never think really of Scotland.
No, you don't. I mean, you don't picture the Scots doing that. And a lot of the, so when I've got this, the witchcraft stuff running through that story, Tansem storyline, I really tried to stick to the historical record because it was so outrageous that you really couldn't make up things more outrageous. You know, the witch finder, the self-proclaimed witch finder general who would go about pricking accused witches to see if they would, you know, scream out in pain when poked with his long, long needle.
Yeah.
And, of course, just went straight back into the barrel. You know, I mean, it's just outrageous. And the numbers of people executed are just horrific. The Scottish government actually, I believe, has issued a pardon. Didn't they issue a pardon recently to all the accused witches?
Wow. Well, I hope so, because this is, you know, it's really, it makes the story so fascinating as it unravels and as the, you know, the current, or the, it was, of course, 1905, when Lady Emily gets involved in the same location, the same, you know, area of where things were happening. So she also has, you know, she's really proven over the years. This is, which book and number is this?
This is 17.
So, you know, Lady Emily is so strong, and you can't imagine. You know, you do imagine if somebody poked Lady Emily.
they better be ready to be poked back.
Yeah, it would not be a pleasant outcome for the person doing the poking.
It would not indeed. And I was very excited to have Jeremy back, because I think Jeremy is always a lot of fun.
Now he's her childhood friend, a good friend. He's been in a lot of the books, and as you say, well, it's fun to have him back because I know the readers enjoy him.
They do, and I think he was, for me, he's always fun to write because he's just he's witty, he's entertaining. But in this book, we see a glimpse into another side of him. You know, Jeremy's oft-spoken goal is to be the most useless man in England. And I say England because I'd always sort of thought Britain, but when we see him in Scotland, he occasionally shows signs of being useful to his Scottish tenants. So, not what I had expected from young Jeremy, but there we have it.
And I love how you really build the background of Scotland, and you talk about so many different elements of dress, of food. You had a lot of fun doing this research.
Oh, I did. And actually, Andrew and I are thinking that we need to design our own tartan after all the research I was doing, because I found a place in Scotland where you can do that.
Well, that brings me to a question from, as you know, when I have you guys on, I get questions from listeners. And
we love
that. One of them is, to keep you in the mood, does Drew wear a kilt at home?
Well, you know, he does have full Highland dress. He also has a set of bagpipes.
Aha! Can you play?
I will say he doesn't wear the kilt as often as anyone would like, but, you know, he does. I have photographic evidence.
Okay, well, you have to post that because I think...
we'll have to see if he'll give permission. I don't know, Andrew. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think you would have to be the judge of that, because if it was down to me, I think you know what I would say.
Well, I do, because he's very modest. But I will tell you, so we went a few years ago, before COVID, to a wonderful event that they have in Boulder, Colorado, every year, called the 1940s Ball. And it's at the small airport in Boulder, and they turn it into the whole scene into World War II. And everyone dresses in you know, 1940s outfits. And we had gone with some very dear friends of ours, including Erica Neubauer, who you may have talked to her about her fabulous, fabulous mystery series. The last one, set in Istanbul, came out earlier this year. And so Erica and I are in our dresses with our victory rolls in our hair. And Andrew had come in Highland dress. Because, you know, obviously the Scots were involved in the war. And I don't think there was anyone at that entire event that got more attention than he did.
Oh.
Everybody wanted to take pictures of him and his kilt.
Not necessarily for the right reasons.
He says that because he's very modest, as we know.
But Erica and Tasha with their special 40s hair and makeup, that was spectacular. That was such a fun day.
It was, but you and your kilt, that was really the feature.
Oh, that really, I think you should publish that picture. I think people would enjoy it because they love the spirit that the two of you have. It's sort of like when I first saw you, the first time I saw you here in St. Petersburg at the Vinoy Hotel, you know, there were thousands of people. But it was so funny that the two of you, just walking down the hallway with the kind of energy and the joy, actually, that the two of you have between yourselves. And when you are in a panel discussion, the way, Tasha, you kept looking at Drew, people noticed it. And I think they enjoy that.
Well, you know, I really like him.
Yeah, I guess. Well, it's funny, after the BoucherCon here at the Vinoy, which was so lovely, really a perfect location for a convention, I went home and it was the first time I looked at Drew's wiki page, and I looked at it, and I turned to my husband and I said, you know, I just love this guy. I said, nobody writes a wiki page like this, and it's so beautiful.
It's great.
I thought, he's real. He's like really real.
He's better than Mr. Darcy.
Yeah, I think so. Drew, for you, I love that you get in the spirit of things.
Well, you know, life is too short to sit on the sidelines. If there's something to be done that's fun, then yeah, we're going to do it.
Well, I've been hoping that you would have an event at St. Albans one day.
I would love that. I would.
You really have to put on a big... I love the idea of dressing in World War II costumes, and that would be fantastic. It would be a wonderful, wonderful event there, because, as you know, we used to walk the grounds. And as a matter of fact, I was looking at some photos, and the exact locations of where we were walking there. And, for you now, with both of you having this love for Scotland, and it's so nice that your books come out in the same month. I think that's exciting.
It is. It's lovely. It hasn't happened very often over the years, so when it does happen, it's really nice. And, these days, events tend to be a lot more online, but it was lovely in the days before COVID when you would go physically to the bookstores and the libraries. It was lovely when we could do that together, because it's so much more fun. And I think for people who came, it was more interesting, because the idea of having two authors living in a house together, working together, it was a different angle that they hadn't come across before. So I think there was a bit of novelty there for everybody.
So, speaking of working in the same house, do you have separate wings that you work?
Well, not exactly wings, but the house has worked out really well for working, because it's set into the side of a hill. So you go in on what you might call, I don't know whether we'd call it the ground floor or the first floor. You know, you walk in, and then there's one floor above where Tasha has her office. Then, because of the way the hill slopes away, there's a kind of finished basement with its own little deck area, which is downstairs, which I work in. So we can disappear off in the morning. She'll go up, I'll go down. And then at the end of the working day, the middle floor, the ground floor, is sort of neutral ground. That's where the kitchen is. That's where we eat. That's where the living room is, where our bedroom is. So it's perfect having this completely separate area for us each to work in, and then having the common ground where we will get together when the day is done.
Oh, I love that you said ground floor. It's so funny. I went to a writer's meeting last week and at a hotel, and I walked into the lobby and I said, where is the writer's meeting? And she said, on the first floor. And so I immediately went to the elevator and went up to the first floor, because for me, it's still, after you live in England, you're so used to saying ground floor, then first floor.
Exactly. It stays with you, doesn't it? And that's one of those things where I have to sort of pause and kind of mentally translate, from one version of English to another. So,
but that's easier than centigrade to Fahrenheit.
Yeah. So. Now, that you have to have some kind of degree in thermodynamics or something to be able to figure that one out.
I agree.
So, and I think for you, Drew, you must have, As I lived in America, there are many places that I've never been to, and with Tasha all doing all of the things that she does and writes about, I bet you've discovered a lot of things about England that you didn't know about before you met Tasha.
Absolutely, and I think that comes through in both of our writing, because we're each looking at the country we write about with a foreigner's eye, and you see so much more. You pick up on things. She's always saying to me, "Wait a minute, why do English people do this? Why do Scottish people do that?" And I'll have no idea, and I've not even have noticed that they were doing it before, because it's just there in the background, and you don't pay any attention. So I think, and you talk about the way she brings these places to life, and I'm sure that's part of it. She sees with a fresh eye, and she will home in on the important detail.
And, of course, we have to mention your book. You're here to talk about your book, too. And the new book is called The Secret. And I love it. This is a retro reacher. I love going back in time. I think it's so so much fun, and it must have been a little bit challenging to remember what people didn't know.
Exactly, and you've got to do, you know, because Reach is established in the present day, there's a lot of things about him that you have to get right for, even if you're showing a younger version of him. So you've got to make sure that Reacher is unwound historically correctly. But then as well, it's not as historical as the things that Tasha does, but just trying to remember and to double check, you know, what kind of technology was there in 1992? What were people doing? What were they driving? What were they watching? And there's also part of the story that links to 1969, so, you know, even further back. So, yeah, I had a little glimpse into the kind of challenges that she has. So it was fun. It gave a different... I'd not done that before, so it gave me a new experience. And, you know, I hope people enjoy it, because we often hear, just like you were saying, Patsy, that people love to see Reacher back in his army days.
Oh, I do. I find it so much fun. And you've done such a wonderful job with it, because I'm reading along and somebody, you know, jumps into a phone booth, and it's so you stop for a minute and you say, "Ooh, yeah, you can visualize that, you know," and it's just so nice. I kept finding these spots where you kept the right time frame. It's, and I mean, we still love, one of the things I think most people do love about Reacher is that he's not, you know, constantly Googling everything in,
Exactly, and he's not looking for opportunities to post pictures on social media or anything like that. But, you know, it was a challenge, because, you know, you're working out the story, you know, in the typical way with my brother, you know, of not planning too far in advance, working out each scene and then saying, okay, what happens next, what happens next? And the what happens next is different, because it can't be that somebody sees an incident and pulls out their cell phone to call the police, because there were no cell phones, you know, things like that. So, you know, I had to think back, especially the telecom stuff I enjoyed, because I was in the industry back in the 90s. And so, you know, the idea that if you had a mobile phone at all, it would be built into your car. I remember those days. I remember the first car I had that had a car phone in it. I went down to the workshop to watch them install it. And it was like one of those scenes that you see in a dock, you know, where a car is come in from a foreign country and the customs people suspect that there's drugs in it, and they rip it apart, and you can't even believe there are so many components in a car. My car was like that, just to install a telephone, you know. So it's fun looking back on those things, and I think it drives the story in a different way too.
Well, I was talking to somebody recently, and I mentioned a telex, and they said, what is a telex?
I know, I used to sell. I made a lot of money selling telexes back in the day. So.
I've never been involved with a telex. I feel like I've missed out.
Yeah. Well, no, they survived way longer than really they should, from a technological point of view, because in the UK, at least, where I was working, there were legal precedents for messages sent by a telex being legally binding. You could confirm a contract via telex long before it was established whether it was binding or not on a fax machine. And nobody wanted to be the first one to try, because if it turned out the contract wasn't binding, obviously they could lose a lot of money. So the big corporations, people where it was critical, they were using telex purely because it had that legal precedent attached to it, long after faxes had really supplanted it from a technological point of view. So for a few years, it was more or less a license to print money, because people had to have them. They had no choice.
Yeah, I remember that, because I was in Iran at the time, you know, when the Shah was giving big contracts to companies all over the world, and the telex machine was going 24/7.
Oh, yeah.
Never
yeah,
stopped.
For that exact reason, yeah.
And I love that sound, I must say.
Yeah, it's one of those. Yeah, it's completely disappeared, hasn't it, from our lives?
So it's sort of like the Selectric typewriter.
Yes, that's another great sound. With that golf ball thing spinning around. Yeah.
So, of course, the secret is, you know, at this point, you're so well known. Your books are so well known, and you know, it's global best selling, because the series, the streaming series, is very popular. When does the next...
Yeah, it's not too far away, season two. I don't have the exact date, but I believe it's going to... I think it's in the sort of ballpark of late November, early December, something like that. So, given that we're in October now, not too far away.
No, just perfect coming out at Christmas. So, when you, you know, of course, Jim is, you know, working with you, and you're having fun. I think with this book, it really, it's like a breakthrough. Where you get this point where you're like, you are so in tune. We feel that you're so in tune. I love when this MP part of Reacher. I think all the readers who get this book will really find it fascinating. First of all, the storyline. Tell us a little bit about the storyline, because I love when he goes in. And, well, I must say, I always love a first chapter that has a real beat to it. And in this case, when we talk about heart throbbing, there's a real heart throbbing in the first chapter.
Yeah, getting the start of the book is always it's the hardest thing to do, I think. I mean, it's the thing that we spend an awful lot of time trying to get right, because what we want to do is kind of set the tone. You know, it's a bit like if it's a piece of music, is it going to be in a major key or a minor key? Is it going to be upbeat, or is it going to be downbeat? Is it going to be big and expansive, or is it going to be small and claustrophobic? And so this time, years ago, I can't remember how many years ago, 2-3 years ago, by chance, Lee and I both read some newspaper stories about a whole load of people, kind of respectable, well-dressed, clearly well-off people, men mainly, all across Eastern Europe, mainly in Russia, mysteriously falling out of windows and falling downstairs and having accidents in their boats, and clearly something was going wrong with it. And together, we both thought, sort of independently, we thought, wow, there's got to be a story here. So when we were talking about what we should do with this next book, we knew that we wanted it to be one a prequel where he's in the army. So we thought, okay, what's the story going to be? So this idea that this mystery, people are being killed, but why? And being killed in these unusual ways, what does that suggest? What does it imply? It just seemed like a really rich vein that we could mine. So we thought, yeah, let's do it. But as we went along, we thought, the stories in the news that we'd read, the people were already dead. There was just a big file with, 8 or 10 of them in there. So we thought, well, wouldn't it be more interesting if we turned it into more of a kind of cat and mouse? So you've got a situation where people are dying. No one knows why. No one knows who's doing it except the reader, because we can let them in on the secret. So the reader knows what's happening, and then they watch Reacher putting the clues together, closing in on whoever's responsible. And, of course, this is a Reacher book, so justice is going to be done at the end, which is fun to write, and I think it's satisfying to read, because even if it's only happening on the page, at least the bad guys are brought to justice, and the right thing is done regardless of the cost. So the whole thing, I was delighted with how it came together, because I really, really enjoyed the sort of the aspect of, we've in the current day books, you see Reacher solving problems and putting the clues together and figuring out the answer, even if it's not the obvious answer to start off with. But he's doing that in a kind of ad hoc, personal way. So I thought it would be fun to have it in more of a sort of procedural way. It's his job to do it back at, in this book, because of him still being a military policeman. But as well as that part, the real world is a bit opaque, isn't it? Nothing is ever quite as clear-cut as it seems. So then you've always got the question of, well, do the authorities really want this puzzle solved, or are they just looking for someone to blame? So you can add in a little bit of that kind of paranoid overtone as well.
Well, it works. I tell you this, it really works. I'm sure the readers are going to be thrilled with it, because every little bit that adds something to the reacher, you know, persona, because there's this part of reacher, this solid part that we really want to believe in, that there are people like that, and that's you bring it out, I think.
Well, thank you. I mean, as Tasha said earlier, you know, you spend a long time working on a book, and when it finally goes out into the world, you don't know how it's going to be received. You don't know if people, you know, you hope that people are going to like it, and it's just the best feeling to hear when you say something like that. So thank you.
So, Tasha, with you, you know, and Lady Emily, one of the things that I like about her, of course, I talked about that she's strong, but I was really impressed with how you had Colin being so tender with the boys. We won't say why, you know, what happened, but Colin really came out in this. I thought how you showed how he really went and, you know, embraced the boys and helped them through difficult things. I like the way you handled Colin.
Well, thank you. And I think, you know, this is the first time we've really seen much of the boys in a while. You know, when they were very little, it's harder to incorporate them. But I've always kind of had it that Colin is more indulgent with them than Emily is. I mean, he's not going to spoil them or turn them rotten. But, just the mechanics of this story really opens the door for us to see him more as a father.
Yeah, explain who the boys,
so we have Henry and Richard, the twins, and then we have Tommaso, short for Tommaso, who is Emily and Colin's ward. And for those of you who have been reading the series, you might remember him as the child of the villain in Death in the Floating City. So when the baby was born, he became the ward of Emily and Colin, and to him, he's the same as their sons, and they're close in age. You know, Tom is only a few months older than the twins, but they each have very distinct personalities. Henry is trouble through and through. he's just trouble.
Yes.
He may or may not have good intentions, but as I think I have written into the next book, when Emily is thinking about him, she's thinking about the fact that if the road to hell is paved with good intentions, most of them are Henry's. Richard is much more serious, but in some ways he loves mythology and legends, and so of course he really loves Scotland, where you've got all these wonderful stories about fairies and kelpies and all these you know, the wonderful legends that you get particularly in the Highlands. And Tom is the perfect little gentleman. He really, I would say of the three, he really tries to emulate Colin the most. And I think, you know, for him, he knows that he is loved like a son. But I think any child, even when you're young, you're going to know, you're probably going to feel differently than you would if you were the biological children rather than a ward.
Well,
the ward isn't the same as an adopted son. You know, so we'll have to see if legally that changes for him eventually, and you know, if such a thing would even be possible. So, but I think he, you know, he wants to be very well behaved. He wants to be an honorable man like his father, because of course he does consider Emily and Colin his parents. But you know, depending on how long the series goes, we may see some interesting development with Tom.
That's right. I love it, and we might even find some. They will drag Lady Emily into some mystery at Eton when they get set.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Which is, you know, where I wanted to go when I was a little girl. I really, as you know, I was 11 when I decided that I was going to move to England. And I didn't really want to wait. I was ready to, you know, cut my hair and dress like a boy sneak
get onto, your tail.
Yeah, sneak onto a ship. I so wanted to go to Eton.
Well, you'd look good in a morning coat.
That's it. Oh, so yeah, I look forward to them going to Eton, to tell you the
so
truth.
So does Emily.
Oh, I love the relationship between all of them. They're really great. It's just fantastic.
Thank you. It's fun to try to write a family dynamic.
Now, for the two of you, of course, being, you know, writers, but you're also great readers. So do you find that you read to, you know, tell each other, like when you find a book and recommend it, or do you physically read books? Because I did read to my husband, English books, because he didn't really, you know, he read, like his mother, he could read in German, so they'd read Thomas Mann in German. His mother could read, you know, all the Russians in Russian. And my husband was well aware of Tolstoy at a very young age, but he never really got into British literature. Well, there was a sort of an anti-British atmosphere
sure.
when he was young.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, there was a little problem because, you know, his mother was, she would ride a horse and deliver messages crossing British lines. So she was, there was a little bit of anti-British, so he never got into it. So I landed up, you know, just because when we traveled, we would go to locations, whether we went to Rome and we went to Keats, you know, to the cemetery where Keats is buried, I would read Keats to him, and he loved when I did that. And this is long before Audible books, and I was like a walking Audible book for him.
That's so great. We tend to, I mean, we read out loud not that often. Once in a blue moon we will, but we absolutely recommend books to each other. I remember one time, this was years ago, we were on vacation, and you know what we were sitting on the beach, and so we just both had brought bathing suits and giant, I mean, our suitcases were just full of books and sunscreen. And I was reading, the first day we got there, I was reading Steve Healy's book, How I Became a Famous Novelist, which is hands down one of the funniest books I have ever read in my life. And so I'm sitting next to Andrew on the beach, and I kept having to read passages out loud to him. They were so funny. And when I finished reading it, he started reading it. And then he was reading passages out loud to me. It's just, the book is such a delight.
And Drew, are you reading poetry to Tasha?
I can't say I have recently, but, you know, we absolutely, like Tasha said, what we love to do is get in a situation where we both have time to read, because, you know, we're working a lot, and that's one thing that is a little frustrating, is we don't get as much time for reading as we would like. So if we can get away together somewhere and have the chance to do that, we absolutely will read. If there's a passage from a book, even just a beautiful sentence, if something crops up, we will read it to each other. And then one of the things that I love the most is, you know, if you come across an idea, a piece of research, a historical fact, something from a book that is fascinating, then, you know, maybe in the evening that's something that you wind up talking about. So, you know, books just fuel so much conversation.
Well, what books did you take along with you? You have to tell my listeners about your recent adventure, because you did something really adventurous.
We did. It's been something that has been 50 years in the making. A dream of mine since I was a little kid was to go to the Galapagos Islands, because when I was very young, my parents took me to there's a zoo near Birmingham where I was born called Dudley Zoo, which I love for many reasons. But one of the reasons was they had giant Galapagos tortoises there. So, you know, my parents took the, you know, little boy to the zoo, and they're thinking, which animal will he like best? Will it be the lions? Will it be the tigers? Will it be the elephant? But no, it was the tortoises. And I've always, from that day onwards, identified with them, because if you watch them, you can see they will stand there, they will be thinking about something, and it will take them a while to come to a decision. But once they decide what they're going to do, there is no stopping them. They will just keep going until they get to where they want to be. And I just identified with that. And over the years, it used to be hilarious, because if I was in a sales job, for example, and the company would bring in psychologists to motivate everybody, they would always start out by, you know, you had a label and you had to write on it what animal represented you. So everybody knew what game they were playing. So everybody would write lion, tiger, cheetah, panther, whatever. And I would always write tortoise. And they, you know, if you're in a corporate environment and you said, yeah, I'm a tortoise, you know, somehow they forget the story of the tortoise and the hare. But, you know, I just had a lot of fun with it, and I always wanted to go. And it's not the easiest thing to organize, because it's a long way away and there's lots of arrangements that are needed, but Sasha put it all together for my birthday this year, so it was fantastic to go on that trip, and I think part of me is still there, honestly.
So how do you get there? What's the route you take?
Well, so you go to Quito in Ecuador, which is just a wonderful city. You know, neither of us had either been there, so we flew to Quito. We had a marvelous guide who took us on a walking tour through the historic part of the city. And then from Quito, the next day, we flew to Baltra Island, which is the island on Galapagos, which has the airport. And from there, we got on a bus that takes you to the port, which from whence you get on a panga, which is what we think of them as zodiacs, but in Ecuador they call them pangas. Panga, panga, I can't remember which is actually correct. And that, we zoomed along in that for probably under 5 minutes, and then we boarded this unbelievable yacht, the Grace, which was built in England, in Southampton, in the 20s. And it was brought into service in the Royal Navy during the war. It rescued people from Dunkirk. It commandeered a German vessel, didn't it, Andrew?
It did, yeah, captured one.
And eventually, after the war, it was, you know, refitted and renovated, because obviously it would need a little TLC post-war, and it became the Royal Yacht of Monaco, and Princess Grace and her husband honeymooned on it, and we were actually in their cabin.
Oh, wow. Now, this is a fantastic, what a trip, what a photo.
Yeah, so we were on the yacht for 2 weeks. It was just magical.
Oh, it sounds lovely. Oh, amazing. Have you ever met Margaret George's tortoise?
No,
I did get to meet Margaret George once, and I love her so much. I just made such a big fool out of myself.
Well,
she came to an event of mine, and I just couldn't, I guess I was trying to do my talk, and I just had to keep stopping, saying, oh my God, Margaret George is here.
Well, she loves your books.
She's amazing. She is just so talented, and nobody is better at bringing historical detail to life without being didactic. You are just there. I adore her.
Well, I flew up to Madison to meet her. Well, actually, in a way, I'm like Drew. I was so fascinated with her tortoise, who is, I think, is now 50 years old. She's had it, you know, for all these years, and I wanted to meet the tortoise.
Yeah.
She invited me for a proper English tea party.
Oh, how fun.
And so I flew up to Madison, and it was winter time, but she has this lovely sunroom. It's so beautiful. And there she had this complete English tea party for me. But the highlight of the day was getting to meet Troilus. His name is Troilus. And so, yeah, you have to get together and meet him.
Yes. For sure.
Well,
but Andrew got to see, you know, hundreds of tortoises.
Oh, wow.
I did. But in my, you know, and you can never have enough tortoises in my book. So it was just, I mean, and of course the other animals there too are extraordinary. You know, the iguanas and the sea lions and all the crazy birds. So everywhere you looked, was amazing. Every island you went to was different. It really was the most magical experience ever.
Well, perhaps the two of you will get together, write a joint book based on this adventure.
I have to say, I did have an idea while we were there, so
yeah.
Never know.
You never know.
Yeah, you never know. Two writers on an adventure.
And of course, you know we were reading Darwin. So.
Of course. Well, it's fantastic. I think it's absolutely wonderful that you did that trip, because it is something very, very special. And I can't believe it's almost the end of the show, so we have to get back a little, because we want to make your publishers happy. I want to make them very happy, because let's talk one last time about your books. For Drew, it's The Secret, and of course with Lee Child and Andrew Child, who remains a child at heart with his tortoises. It's the latest Jack Reacher. It is number 28, I think, right? 28?
I think so, yes.
Number 28. Oh, wow. So, everybody, you can get it. It's really so intriguing, and you will love Reacher as an MP. I got a kick out of that. And, of course, Tasha, it is so wonderful that you have captured Scotland in such a way that everybody's going to want to get up and take a trip and visit Scotland. So it's just amazing. I think I'm so thrilled that you're both on today, and we want to make sure that everybody's listening. Go to wherever books are sold, I'm sure. Wherever, if there are really bookstores open again, thank goodness, they can find your books.
Well, thank you so much, Patsy. And, you know, we just can never thank you enough for all that you do for us writers, for readers. You really just, nobody else, I can't think of anyone else who even comes close to doing for books what you do.
Well, as I said, somebody recently said to me, you're the last of the Red Hot Book Lovers.
Yeah, really are.
And I thought, well, that actually is very appropriate, because I get...
Because you are red hot.
I am. So it's funny. I love it. And I'm so always so happy to talk to you. And thank you so much for joining me. And I'm always looking forward to your next books, okay?
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you, Patsy, and let's hope we speak before, but if not, then let's do it again next year.
Yes, let's do it again before then.
Okay, absolutely. I really do want you on so that we can talk Charlotte Bronte and Jane Austen. How about that?
That sounds perfect. And let's set a date.
And we'll set up a little trollop and a little... How about that?
Lady Glencora.
Oh, okay, I'm going to give you a date, and you're going to come back on Joy on Paper, okay?
We are looking forward to it.
Okay,
fantastic.
Great.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Patsy.
Bye-bye now. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Wow. Oh, what a wonderful day. Absolutely. Anyway, everybody, remember, say something nice to somebody today, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for everything. He saluted me. I saluted him. I should have been a general. It's a fantastic day today. Bye-bye now.